My guest this evening has performed around the world in Mexico, Hamburg, Cork, Milan, New York, and Los Angeles.
That sounds great.
As well as all around the UK. So, Iris Gerolfs, welcome.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. So, starting from the very beginning, where are you from?
Well, I was just about to say from Moon or some kind of planet far away, but unfortunately that's not true. I'm from a small village in Hanover, near Hanover in Germany. And I've just discovered that it's the whole area is pretty similar to Essex, apart from that it's in Germany.
Well, is that because you have the Shav culture or...?
No, I don't think so. It's just these very pretty little villages sort of close to a town where quite wealthy people live in sort of done-up old farmhouses, basically. So, yes, so I'm an Essex girl at heart.
So, before you went to university, because you went to university in Germany...
Well, kind of. I did go to university, but not really. I was registered. It's in those days you didn't have to pay for university, and I was registered for a hell of a long time, but I kind of didn't study. So I didn't have a very good experience of academia or school or anything then, and I just didn't go.
So had you studied music before your involvement in sound?
I had studied a bit privately, yes. And
so what did you learn? What did you study?
What I studied and what I learned are two different kettle of fish. What I studied was a bit of sort of singing and a bit of jazz composition, and what I learned from it is to stay away from both. Because what I felt that I was being taught is not so much a technique, but rather sort of a style that you assimilate, and that it becomes very much sort of body memory, and that's then sort of very difficult to sort of get out of that.
Because musicians have that, don't they? They have this sort of finger memory.
Yes.
Okay. So how did you become interested in sound? The concept of working with sound?
Yeah, it's a good question. Maybe I should start how I became interested in music and improvisation, because that is really sort of my first base in things. So I think that started quite early, because my parents were in a little choir in the village that we lived in, and they would practice at home, and I began quite early to sort of make up melodies to go with what they were practicing. And I really loved that and enjoyed that, and would then proceed to sing in the car and annoy anybody driving with me. And I think that is sort of how things started. I was in various bands, and to cut a long story short, sort of in the 80s, late 80s, I began to sort of make music with MIDI and computers, because bands have always found a bit of a difficult experience. Because as a singer, you have a very sort of prescribed role, and people that I played with were mostly guitar playing blokes, and that's a sort of fairly limited concept as far as I'm concerned. And so I had my troubles with that. And when I discovered computers and sort of MIDI sequences sort of in the late 80s, I just loved it and started to be quite composed with that and be quite anal about sitting there and writing stuff. So I had a little MIDI sequencer called the Roland MC500, and thinking about this, I've still got it, I think. I'm very attached to my old equipment.
So
but you were asking about how I got interested in sound. And I think sort of as I sort of further sort of removed myself sort of from the idea of music through sort of working with data, essentially, I think sort of the whole idea of what I was working with or what interested me changed, and the sort of texture of what I was working with, the kind of aesthetical side of the textures that I was working with changed, and sort of And it was sort of, I don't think there was sort of any point in time where I would say, well, I'm working with sound or I'm working with sort of musical, within musical boundaries. I think that sort of went away quite sort of naturally. And I don't really sort of make a distinction now. I mean, it's just sort of a spectrum.
So was there any one person or a group of people who were an inspiration for you?
Yeah, I think loads. I mean, sort of early on, it was a lot of vocal performers that I really loved. And I was mainly fascinated by the differences in sort of sound quality that these singers had and how they sort of modulated their voices and how the voice was very differently modulated, say, in classical music or in jazz or in soul. And you're sort of trying to imitate it and sort of trying to sort of feel that different sort of resonance inside you. It's been quite a big influence. But also a big jump sort of the electronic music sort of in the 90s, I think, has been a big influence. And I sort of I remember being at a conference of a concert of Mouse and Mars in Kentish Town, and it wasn't very busy. And I just loved it, and I thought, God, this is really something that that I'm really attracted by. Sort of the rhythmic side and the sort of melodic side and the sound side of things came together in a way that I really enjoyed.
Because a vocal performer, Joan LaBarbera, I mean, her voice is. Did you sort of model on her in any way at all?
No, I discovered her a hell of a lot later than that. No, I hadn't heard of her for a very long time.
So, before we have your first composition here with us, but before we listen to that, could we listen to something that's current? And will you introduce it?
Well, I thought maybe not something that current, but I think that's a sort of... brings together sort of the sort of vocal side and the sort of more abstract side, I think, quite neatly, because it has diverged quite a bit sort of in recent times. So this is a play piece, I should say, called Stimmung, and it's it has been really sort of a little soundtrack for a little film that I made with my ex-husband, filmmaker Maria Radunovic, and I still really like it. So here we go. Da 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 da
So, Iris, do you have a particular methodology of putting a composition together, or is it just as inspiration takes you?
Well, the method is painful, normally.
Painful?
It's pretty painful. The way it normally works is I think I work very much like a collage artist works, like, only that I sort of have very precise and strict feelings as to what needs to go where, and sometimes it takes an awful lot of experimentation and time to just get it right in the sense that I feel it the way it has to be at that point in time, and I can't bear if it's not, doesn't reach that point.
So
in that sense it's painful.
So there isn't a... So when you start, there isn't a concept there. It's just when you start putting things together, you start... Your feeling, your instinct takes you in a particular direction.
Well, there might be a concept there in terms of, say, if it's an installation or something, then I'll be working with a certain idea in mind, with a certain theme in mind, and that will sort of set the scene for what I'm doing. I might be collecting sounds in a given situation, sort of in a special certain environment, or I might be using my own voice. But I don't have a composition as such in my head. I just sort of feel it as it emerges, and it sort of one step sort of leads me to the next kind of thing.
So the sounds, they lead you. They lead you on.
Yes. So, sorry, I was just thinking, lead me on? No. They do lead me, yes.
All right, lead me on, bad phrase. Now, on the turntable, we've got your first...
They have their demands, I think that's a good way of putting it. They demand to be put in certain ways.
Okay. Okay, on the turntable, we've got your first pressing, a 45. Would you like to introduce it for us, please?
Yes, this is also a collaboration with an artist called Alexander Zelsky, who is a painter living in Berlin, where I was living at the time. Because this has done... Let me just have a look. I think... yes, it's 1989. It doesn't bear thinking about, doesn't it?
Don't go there.
Yeah. And I hadn't looked at it or heard it for a very long time. And just looking at it, I think it looks really good. You know, I really like it.
It looks great.
It's a little sort of 7-inch white label with sort of black markings around. And this piece is called The Circle, and it was done with an Atari and a MC500, Roland MC500 MIDI sequencer that I used at the time, and a few sound modules that I was also using at the time. And I think one of them was, what is it called? MKS7. I can't remember what make it was, but I loved it. And I still know the number of my favourite drums, my favourite bass sound, which is number 19. Yes. So shall we play that then?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Light is
So I'm brutal because you can edit it out.
Brutal.
Yes, here we go. I forgot to mention the track is called The Circle. And it's got very interesting harmonies, doesn't it?
Oh, it sounds great. Good. Love it. So while you were all listening to that, I was saying to Iris that I do think she should put that up on the website, on her website. We'll get to the details a wee bit later on.
Well, my website, yes. Mm. It's just being made anew.
Oh, great. Coming back to your current work, your sounds are very detailed. Do you use a lot of processing?
At times, yes. I sometimes do and I sometimes don't. It sort of depends on what the aesthetics are for each thing that emerges and where sort of the mood takes me, basically. Sometimes I don't use very much at all. Sometimes I use quite a lot. I have pieces where there isn't very much at all. Like, we were talking about the Swan Song installation a little while ago, and even though it sounds quite processed, it isn't. It was just the quality of the sounds that sort of emerged during the making of it or the recording of it. Mm-hmm.
Swan Song, that was your installation in Leeds, in the courts.
Yes, a couple of years ago at Evolution Festival. And it was about a lady, young woman, who got sentenced to death there for the murder of her husband together with her lover. And it's sort of a two-channel piece that takes an inspiration from her last conversation that she had on the gallows with him. Mm. Yeah. And for that, I recorded a lot in the courts and in the prison downstairs where she would have been. And so did a little bit of processing, but it was mainly sort of pitch shifts to get a little bit of sort of movement in there.
So with your installation work, and maybe at this time it's a good point to ask you the question, do you regard yourself as a sound artist, installation artist, composer? How would you describe yourself?
That is a really tricky terminology mud bath. I really have problems with that because I sort of feel that I take in a lot from these areas, but I don't inhabit any one of them exclusively, nor do I think is sound art or sort of composer such a helpful term these days. So I'm always a bit baffled. I mean, I'm pushed, I probably would say sort of sound artist stroke composer, because even though the sound arty projects kind of are more conceptual, they do have a very strong aesthetic feel to them, and I think about them aesthetically a lot as well, so they are always composed to some extent, even though it might be sort of randomly kind of having random elements in it.
So do you feel that sound art occupies a ground sort of somewhere between fine art and musicology?
Well, I think I'm not sure where I'm standing on this at this present time, because I think if you put it sort of in that sort of art context, you automatically think about sort of an object-oriented view. And I'm thinking sometimes sort of in an object-oriented view, but sometimes in a process-oriented view. And then a lot of music becomes sound art as well, because it takes in processes from the arts world. For example, sort of Keith Rowe was describing it as sort of putting a table, a guitar down, like people were putting their paintings down on the floor and then seeing what you could do with that. So that is sort of a very process-based sort of movement from sort of art into sort of the sound world. So it sort of really depends on how you think about these things and how you apply them. So I'm not sure whether sound art as such is such a... Yeah, whether the term itself is terribly helpful. Mm. No, I mean, I think Douglas Kahn called it sort of the art of sound, which might be a little bit more, a little bit wider.
Because it can be confusing, because you take, someone like Xenakis, who in 1973-4 did his Polytope, which was an installation of sound, but and light as well, and something like 200,000 people came to see this. And to me, that combination makes it an installation and a piece of art, a self-standing sound art.
Yeah.
It's always interesting to hear the definitions and, you know,
Max Neuhaus sort of defined it. It's sort of the combination of sound and kind of art that makes it sound art.
Mm.
And that he sort of didn't really allow sort of any other interpretations than that. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably a definition in progress.
Mm. Continuing. To be continued.
Yes.
Okay. So when it comes to...
Time-based.
So when it comes to a composition, Iris, do you think about... I mean, we've talked about the conceptual approach, in fact, the way you approach a new piece of work. But do you start out thinking about it in a terms of, you know, multi-channel installation? You mentioned Swan Song, which was a stereo piece.
Mm.
But there are, I would assume, and looking at your discography, there are numerous installations which have been multi-channel. So how do you approach that particular aspect?
I think it's quite sort of space dependent, sort of what the given situation is. I do really love multi-channel, so I aim for as much as I can, you know, do technically or financially or, you know, whatever, or size of the space, and then I would sort of do the composition for a certain amount of channels, and also the position of the channels, because the way you hear the sounds and the way they work together are very much based in where they are placed. I mean, if you think about a sort of a stereo field, you know, you try in sort of transitional sort of recording ways, you try to separate them by different means of panning them, by different means of applying reverb, by sort of slight or not so slight frequency separation, so that you get a sort of position. And then often when you put it into mono, where everything is sort of on top of each other, it sounds dreadful, because frequencies now get in their way and movements get in their way. So the same is, in my opinion, if you compose something for stereo and then try to put it into different channels or into more channels, then you lose an opportunity. And also you don't get sort of a placement where you place the sounds in space. So I would always compose or make a piece for however many channels I wanted to use.
So how do you feel about mono?
Well, mono is a single channel, so I don't really have any particular feelings about it, other than I prefer having more channels and more than stereo as well. But I have done live performances in mono because of there only being that sort of technical equipment available and as a scale down. And that's fine. You just, you know, approach what you do with that in mind, because you can't do certain things that you would do kind of movement wise putting certain frequencies together.
Mm. Okay, let's hear another piece of music.
Actually, I've got that scaled down piece here. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
The mono piece, that is. Since we can't play multi channel here, we'll just find it.
So yeah, it's been a long time, but we're glad to have it back. So if you could all put your hands together and welcome Iris Carell.
So okay. Yes, iris and mono.
Iris in mono. Very good, very good. Iris, what do you rate as your best gig?
My best gig?
Ooh. Yeah.
They're all good, aren't they?
Of course. But there must be one that's
no,
a standout.
A few atrocious ones. I think the best one is actually one where I didn't play, where I was kind of more conducting and doing a bit processing. And the reason I'm saying that is that sort of a fellow composer came up saying, "Oh, Iris, you like the Karajan of, what did he say, electronic music or something?" And I just love that phrase. It's just, you know, God, Karajan, do you really want to be like Karajan? But it really stuck in my mind. And it was a piece that we did as part of an artist's cooperative called Urbania. And we were taking part at the Royal Academy's GSK Contemporary Season in 2009, I think, the winter. And it was a four-channel piece. And I had build some instruments during a residency with these people up in the Lake District, and I really loved the way sort of my whole sort of practice sort of changed from being very sort of digital, you know, completely sitting there sort of moving sort of data instances around, and then building a little stone xylophone, a little stone mobile, a little sort of tweak guitar type thing, and it sounded fantastic. And these little, the xylophone, and I just picked up these sort of slats of stone, and they were in tune. I was really amazed. And there's a little piece on YouTube, sort of me singing along with them. Sort of, yeah, I just loved it. So basically, and I got my fellow artists to play the instruments, and I made sort of a piece for them, or instructions as to play, how to play, and I was, yeah, directing it and processing it, and that was really very enjoyable.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, if that was the best, how do you feel about telling us what the worst was?
The worst? That must probably be a festival in France. Can't even remember what it's called. Somewhere, Marseille, I think it was. And I got really pissed off at the audience. It was quite a confrontational sort of festival type setup, though. It was a very high stage, and I'm not very good with stages anyway, because I sort of don't like sort of looking down on people and people looking up, and what I do doesn't lend itself to sort of that dichotomy, really. And so there was this audience and me up there, and it just didn't gel. And I just got into this really stroppy, aggressive mood. So what I played sounds quite nasty. Like, fuck you, I might have to edit that. But yeah,
no.
Sort of, yeah, and I think it wasn't very successful because of that. Because I was, yeah.
Well, so the audience were confrontational before you even got up there. You know, how many acts were there appearing at the gig? Or were you solo? Was it a solo?
No, there were other people playing as well. David Toop, I think, was on as well. I can't remember any of the other people. Mm. It's a few years ago now.
Mm. Well, I think we all have them, don't we? So, what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm sort of rethinking a lot of how I'm working, or what my work consists of, because I have been doing a lot of audiovisual works for a long time, and I used to work as a photographer at some point, and I always felt that somehow the visual side and the sort of sound side are on one hand quite on two different tracks, but at the same time they have a very strong influence on each other. So the PhD looks at how that works, and at the moment I'm doing a lot of writing and sort of thinking about how that works. I'm doing a few little pieces, bringing in sound and any other sort of works or working methods or working levels or platforms, and thinking on how that might widen out or enrich or change what I'm doing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I have one project that I'm working with that brings together drawing and sound, and I've done a little outing of that at a little place called the Muse out in West London a while ago, and it didn't work very well. That hasn't proved very successful at this point in time. I'm keep working at it, and it's sort of all really a bit up in the air at the moment, and I find that really exciting. Sort of that sort of point where I'm sort of feeling, oh, I have sort of this opportunity now to sort of really reflect on what I'm doing and going a bit more in depth rather than sort of in outputting stuff. And that is just absolutely fantastically fun. Yeah.
Because as part of your education, you took a course in design and photography. So what was it that made you, because prior to that you'd worked, you'd done sound engineering and you'd done classic voice and vocal improvisation courses prior to that. So what was it that took you down the design and photography route?
Well, it was sort of, I've always sort of taken photographs, and for some reason I started to make some money from it. So working for magazines, I did some stuff for The Wire, for Marie Claire, and for Keyboard magazine in Japan. And so I thought, ooh, just wouldn't it be exciting to learn a bit more about this? And so I did that. It was a part-time course, so plenty of time to do other things, such as start to do Sprawl, I think, sort of pretty much at the same time as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Sprawl, because you're a co-founder of Sprawl. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I've been doing that together with Douglas Benford since 1996. So it's also a very long time. And it's sort of, I mean, the whole landscape in London then was very, very different in terms of venues that were available, in terms of music that was sort of being listened to generally. And we sort of felt that we didn't really have anywhere to go to that was interesting, sort of on a more regular level. I mean, there was sort of Scanners Electronic Lounge, which was interesting, but that was sort of not that regular. So we set up a night to do that, and the idea was to bring in sort of a lot of the emergent technology-driven artists over. We had sort of really early on sort of internet link-ups. So we had people coming over from Japan and from America and everywhere, sort of did one of the sort of very early laptop performances. And it was really interesting also to bring together sort of new artists, people that were just starting out to do something, and sort of more established artists. And yeah, we sort of termed it at the time sort of a test tube, sort of for, you know, emergent and sort of established ideas.
That was great. So it was offering ideas and inspiration to up-and-coming artists as well.
Yeah, and a place where people could just try out stuff without, you know, without pressure that it has to be good or exciting or this and that and the other. So it was quite a social space as well. We did it sort of in one of the early internet cafes as well. So
so how often do you meet up?
Well, at that time, we had a period when we were doing it once a week, and that was just a bit ambitious. So we had for most of the time, it was running once a month. And since our 10th anniversary, we do it just sporadically. Sort of, we have done some festivals as well, and now we're doing, so focusing more sort of on special events and sort of some commissions and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So how many are there of you all together now?
It's just two of us. It's just Douglas and Douglas Benford and myself.
Right.
No interns. No.
So what about your next live performance? When can we come and see you?
It's going to be a little while off still. It's at the beginning of June at the Text Festival in Bury.
In Bury?
Mm.
So how did that come about?
One of the organisers contacted me. I'd contributed to this book, Playing With Words, and one of the organisers had come across it and then sort of looked into what I'm doing and contacted me through that.
Great. Have you been to Bury before?
No.
Well, an experience for you. Okay, so let's hear some more. What have you got for us?
I thought it might be quite nice to play a little bit more of an abstract piece. Because I do sort of my being enamoured with voice and not sort of goes in circles and cycles. And even though sort of most of my stuff is based on processed voice, not everything is. And a little while back, I did a performance at the Science Museum to support Brian Eno's Apollo as part of the sort of whole moon landing spectacular they were organising then. And I made this piece called Star Maker. I have to say, I am a huge sci-fi fan, so hence the early mention of me wanting to be from the moon and I'm not and stuff. So basically, this piece, Star Maker, is sort of inspired by this one section in Olaf Stapledon's early novel of the same name. I think it's from 1937, and it basically describes a sort of hero travelling through space or flying through space and moving around, and can really imagine myself doing that once I'm disembodied. So here is an extract of Star Maker. Okay, here's it. Star Maker live at the Science Museum. A little while back, I can't remember the year now. I think it was, no, it's 2009.
Thank you.
Okay, we've been listening to Star Maker. Iris, what sounds did you use in putting that composition together?
Even though it sounds remarkably similar to the ones where I'm using voice and processing, it's got no voice in it. I've used sort of radio emissions from heavenly bodies as found on the internet and played around with those.
So where were they from?
Some are from the sun, some are from Ganymede. Ganymede? Ganymede? I don't know how you pronounce it, actually.
Ganymede, yeah.
Some are from Ganymede. They're captured by radio telescopes, basically, and some of them are put on the internet.
Because that would be very interesting, wouldn't it, to take sounds off a radio telescope on a direct feed, if there is such a thing, if one is able to do that.
Funny enough, I mean, I did a project for Resonance a little while ago. Well, quite a long time ago, actually, now. Which is called Talking Space to Space, and it's sort of a partially alive performance. I've put out a little recorded extract of that on vinyl as well, funnily enough. But the idea was to manipulate sort of sounds coming from live feeds and then put them out live again. We couldn't do that live because we didn't have a live feed at the time, but sort of an extrapolated sort of idea of mine is to do a kind of a global wide performance stroke installation at some point, global multi-channel installation.
Wow.
Where you have all these things coming and me processing that, and that's putting it out from different ones all around the world. Any funders out there?
What a great idea.
Yeah, so that's kind of my love of sci-fi talking there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, well, good luck with that one. Oh, that's a superb idea.
It'd be good fun.
So, Iris, look, reading through your discography and CV, you've collaborated with many people. You've done so many performances around the world, as I said at the outset. Have you had some favourite collaborations?
I really love collaborating with other people. I think it's one of the most sort of challenging and also interesting ways of working. And I think the one I really enjoyed most was with Obenio, I mentioned earlier. And partially, I think, because none of them were sound artists or musicians, they all came from sort of visual or other performance arts fields. And it really expanded the way that I thought about working with sound because of that, just because it brought in other working methods and other sort of ways of seeing things or hearing things.
Mm.
And it was quite interesting because I come from such a sort of musical background. And I was talking to Max Eastley recently, and he sort of also comes from a much more sort of fine arty kind of background. And when he sort of started, it went sort of in the other way. And he described the process as sort of changing your mind in terms of sort of creating the sensibilities and the way sort of he's working now. And I think I did a little bit of a sort of step in the other direction. And it's also about sort of changing your mind, and it's an utterly fascinating process.
Mm. So have you got any examples of some collaborations you could play to us?
Since we're talking about sprawl, it might be a nice idea to do a collaboration that I did with Douglas. We haven't done that many of them, funnily enough, because our sensibilities are quite different, sort of musical sensibilities. And this, we were asked to do a cover, an Out of Noise cover. So this is Douglas Benford and Iris Garelves playing Donna. And I'm not just singing that on there, even though I do.
Thank you.
Bukharis, thank you very much. As a final question for you, and probably a wicked question, but I'll ask it anyway. So where do you see yourself, or where would you like to be in 5 years' time?
Ooh, a nice palace on a desert island.
How many speakers?
So 5 years is such an immense amount of time. And if I look back at the last 5 years, sort of things change in such ways as it's very difficult to predict where things are going. But from where I am at the moment, I think I would like to be working on longer projects. I'd love to do some longer lasting residencies, sort of getting involved with people just a bit more intensively. So for a lot of stuff that happens or has happened in my life, I've felt that it's such a shame that, you know, you just dash in somewhere and out of somewhere, and it's kind of rather superficial. And I would really love to have a little bit more time.
So you feel that having that extra time would give the experience of whether it was a performance or a residency that greater meaning for both?
Yeah, so if it's a performance sort of ending a residency or something, it would just make it a bit more pertinent as to the experience, as to the people that are there. Because, you know, people do shape what you do. I mean, even in a sort of, you know, fly-in, fly-out sort of life situation, you do, yeah, as I described with it in Marseille, you know, it has quite a profound impact on what happens. And I think it'd be really nice to make that a little bit more sort of in-depth and meaningful.
So would you still like...
Sounds very hippie, doesn't it?
So would, as well as the longer pieces, would you still like to be performing?
Yes, I do. Yes, I think performances are definitely part of my output. The way I do them has changed, and the way I sort of view them has changed as well. they're not so much sort of definite points in time or nodes of... They're not so much sort of, in my view, sort of finished things. They're just sort of nodes and snapshots of a place and a time and a response to that through live performance, I think.
And that performance reflects how you were at that particular moment in time and space.
Yes, I guess so.
Okay, well... Iris Garros, thank you very much indeed for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's like Desert Island Discs.
And for those of you who want to find out some more about Iris and her work and how she's getting on, her website is www.irisgarolfs.com.